Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Okay, nerd alert. Have you ever wondered why characters in TV shows and movies and novels where the action plays out on distant planets or entirely mythological worlds tend to speak modern-sounding English? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Part of the reason, of course, is that those faraway realms, in fact, spring from the minds of English-speaking novelists and screenwriters. J.R.R. Tolkien cared enough about accuracy to write some dialogue in Elvish, a language he made up himself. And George R.R. Martin included a small amount of this in the Game of Thrones books. That, for the uninitiated, was Dothraki. And for the TV series Game of Thrones, the creative team outsourced the construction of more of that language than Martin ever wrote to my guest, David J. Peterson. He's a linguist who has also created languages for Penny Dreadful, Defiance, Dominion, The 100, and Thor, among others. His new book explains the incredible amount of choices he had to make along the way, and in the process provides a great deal of insight into how any language functions and what it reveals about the culture that uses it. David Peterson, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Long before you had even imagined a career in linguistics, you had an ear for constructed language that did not make any sense to you. Let's listen to a clip from Return of the Jedi that probably passed unnoticed to a lot of other people.
We have powerful friends. You're going to regret this.
That's not actually the clip that we were looking for, but there is some Jabba the Hutt talking there. The one that made you crazy, David, was in fact Leia, Princess Leia, dressed up as another character entirely and speaking another language.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a scene that occurs a little earlier, I'm pretty sure. I think it occurs a little earlier. And what happens is that she's dressed up as a bounty hunter, an Ubi's bounty hunter, apparently. And she has some sort of a voice modification, so you don't know it's her and it doesn't sound like her. But she's having a negotiation with Jabba the Hutt, with C-3PO acting as an intermediary, where she is negotiating a price to sell Chewbacca to Jabba the Hutt. And it's kind of it's a ruse on her part. But essentially, there's this bizarre exchange where she says kind of the same thing several times in a row, but it's translated as by C-3PO as something different each time. And I don't think that, it wasn't a ruse, like C-3PO wasn't in on the ruse. He was just translating as faithfully as he could, being a translator that speaks thousands of languages. So as a viewer, we were left to kind of accept this language where you could say the same thing several different times in one conversation and it means something different each time, which no language on earth has ever done.
Yeah, if you're going to make up a language, you might make all the rules, but the reality is you must have rules for it to actually work.
Yeah, that's correct. And in my book, that's basically what I go into. But essentially, this is what a lot of us have done for fun for years and years and years, just sit down and create languages. At the beginning, I think it was just for ourselves, just because it was kind of a need. And then when we found other language creators online and keyed into a community, we were also sharing our work with one another and learning from one another. And that's what I've been doing for 15 years now.
So this term conlang for constructed language has this kind of nerd chic cachet in a way that feels very modern. But it turns out you've discovered that the practice has a long history that far predates the Internet.
That's correct. The earliest documentation you can say we have of a language creator or somebody engaging in activities that were like language creation comes from the 12th century. There was a German abbess named Hildegard who did many things, in her lifetime. But among some of the things she did is she created a word list, which she called her lingua ignota, which is Latin for unknown language. And the name is in Latin. It's not in her language, where she created a huge word list of made-up words for all different kind of aspects of life. And she created, and she was a hymn writer. So among the things she did was she wrote hymns using these words, which she believed were divinely inspired. And that was, basically that's become a part of her legacy. So now on her saint day, Conlanger's kind of celebrated as our holiday. She's considered the patron saint or matron saint of Conlanging.
Now, Hollywood, you know, on the one hand likes to spend money on these big budget pictures. On the other hand, it takes money to hire a linguist to consult and create a language. Why is this something that anybody would bother with?
Well, honestly, I think it's just that movies, especially in the early 2000s, movies like The Lord of the Rings, but also even, you know, blockbusters like Spider-Man, kind of upped the game. So first, we'll start with Spider-Man. I think that one, that movie kind of launched the whole superhero craze and essentially elevated geek chic to mainstream. Whereas, you know, nerd used to be a pejorative. Now it's, you know, everybody's coming out of the woodwork to say they're a nerd in one way or another. So, I mean, that was part of it. And then the other part is just the Lord of the Rings movies, I think, demonstrated to everybody that we could actually do an epic fantasy the right way, exactly the way that we imagined, so that all the effects look crisp and perfect. The you know, the battle scenes were truly enormous, and every single detail could be gotten right down to Tolkien's languages. And, you know, Peter Jackson was a big fan of Tolkien, and Tolkien, of course, was a big fan of language and of his created languages, so it wouldn't have felt right if they didn't have the actual dialogue that was authentically translated into his languages.
I got way too excited in the book reading that the first time Hollywood, that you could document, Hollywood hired a linguist to commission a new language was this delightfully cheesy 1970s kids show.
Right, yeah, that was Victoria Fromkin, who was hired to create a Pakuni language for Land of the Lost, which I watched as a kid. But I have to say, I didn't even know that there was a created language in it as a kid. I don't think many people did. So even though, like, unless somebody has an earlier date, I think that was the first time in history anybody was hired to create a fictional language. They really didn't make a big deal of it. The producers didn't. I mean, they didn't, you know, advertise it. I think that she had a little, kind of a little write-up in TV Guide at the time, but that was it, you know?
Tucker!
Wait a minute, Chaka. Somebody chased you? Chi ye?
No! It gove me chi! Me wom, wom, wom! It gove kudu chi! Ego e chiga!
Wait a minute, Chaka. You ran to this place? Ye wom? Eh?
Anu nun me! No Chaka! It gove! It gove be sasa!
What's a gobi, Chaka? You're not making any sense.
They might have spent a little money on acting coaches for the youthful actors, yeah. But when you hear that...
That was adorable.
It sounds to you like a real language because it follows some rules.
Yeah, she actually... I mean, you know, it was an early attempt, and she didn't probably have a lot of knowledge of other language creators, but there are rules that she created. There's systematicity there. And it's interesting. I swear that's the first I've ever heard it. I mean, probably not, because I used to watch it when I was 3 and 4. But, you know, I didn't pay much attention back then. But that's actually a nice little scene where they're actually, it sounds like they're trying to teach the viewer at least some words so they kind of can understand what they're saying. I don't know. It's a nice idea. I mean, not brilliantly acted maybe, but, you know, it's a nice idea. I like it.
Let's talk about how you got the gig that made you, if not the father, like the stepfather of Dothraki and both forms of Valyrian heard on Game of Thrones. It started with this call for proposals in the form of a contest.
Yeah, this was announced by the Language Creation Society, and it was kind of announced all over the internet, certainly. everywhere that a language creator would look. But it was kind of the announcement was more like, you know, it was just said, create a language for a television show. It didn't say anything other than that. So I think that there may have been a lot of conlangers who didn't, you know, didn't think that it was legit. And, you know, you can't blame them for doing so. But, you know, I and many others at least looked into it. And of those that looked into it, like 40 ended up asking for an application. And of those, I think there were 30-some that ended up turning in applications in the first round. And I was among them. And so that first round was judged by other language creators who then chose 5 proposals to move on to the next round. And then of those, mine was chosen as the winner. So I ended up being language creator for Game of Thrones.
And you went above and beyond with your entry.
Yeah, so the way that the contest was worded, essentially, you had to do certain very minimal things, and then the last item was, you know, you can submit anything else you want to be considered. And so my goal then was to provide the most information possible and make it as detailed as possible. So in the first round, I sent off 181 pages of material. And then, you know, when I that was kind of a relief. I was like, all right, that's done. Doesn't matter if I get to the finals or not, whatever, I did it. Then I found out I got to the finals, and I was like, okay, here we go again. So I upped that from 181 pages to 300 pages of material, and that was my final proposal. It included the full grammar and lexicon of Dothraki, all the translation needed for the pilot, and then some miscellaneous other materials that I thought, you know, would be fun.
David J. Peterson is my guest. He's a linguist who has created languages for TV series, including Game of Thrones, Penny Dreadful, Defiance, and Dominion. His new book is called The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind World Building. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
We come as friends.
Begging your pardon, milady. We'll be the judge of that.
Valar Morghulis.
Valar Dohaeris.
Olvi vilti rulloro kel brianen desum dao.
Thoros chen mirotixa. Voctus eglia ot gaimo laxir teptas. Roberti dari zihi ne keptis exiot onio gemagon. Scoriomassitas.
Crin conta.
Aole ruda numas maisa. Cuptesi puntali jo hexis e gemosu.
Au hosso ziri rigibia, senio hosso ziri rigibu. Cuptengo sengo so itrasis.
My friends here don't speak High Valyrian. Why are you here, my lady?
That was a scene from Game of Thrones between Melisandre and Thoros of Myr speaking High Valyrian. At the end of their conversation, Thoros asks her in Valyrian if she speaks the common tongue before explaining that my friends do not speak High Valyrian. You're listening to Think. My guest this hour is linguist David J. Peterson, who has created languages including High and Low Valyrian and, of course, Dothraki for Game of Thrones. He's also done languages for Defiance and Dominion and Penny Dreadful. His new book is called The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind World Building. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, David, when you're coming up with the high and low version of a language, what do you have to think about in terms of what they have in common and the places in which they diverge?
In this case, what I did was I looked at George R. R. Martin's books and examined the history that he presents to us. So, for example, we know that High Valyrian was spoken in an area called the Valyrian Freehold at a time in the distant past, and it was spoken for many years. Then what happened is that when people left, they kind of took the language with them, and it evolved as it went. In the case of the low Valyrian that we hear in the show, which is Astapori Valyrian, kind of the Slaver's Bay variety of Valyrian, what happened is that the old Giscari Empire and the old Valyrian freehold went to war many, many times. Eventually, the Valyrian freehold just completely won out and destroyed the old empire and kind of made it one of their satellites. And so what happened is that the language that would have been spoken there, it would have been spoken by people who previously spoke Giscari, who then had the High Valyrian language forced on them as the language of business and the language of government. And then that was kind of like state zero. Then it evolved from that period several thousand years into what we now see today. And so what you'll find is a language that has a Valyrian-like structure, at least evolved structure, with Giscari loanwords sprinkled throughout and every so often kind of a Giscari structure. And that's very different from the language that was spoken in the Valyrian freehold many years ago. So that was the situation and how I did those languages.
That's a pretty astonishing amount of work, considering that these languages didn't really exist before. Martin wrote a few words of them. And it makes us think about, you know, the words in English and the way that this language has evolved. Many of them have meanings that today have very little to do with the original meaning. And a single example in English is the word can. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. But actually, before getting to can, I would just say there's a nice parallel where with the Norman conquest in English, we got a lot of French words that came into English because of the Norman conquest and gave us bizarre little distinctions like mutton versus lamb. Lamb was an old English word. Mutton comes from mouton, the French word for lamb. But now mutton is the word for eating lamb because that's the word that English-speaking servants would use when they served the French masters.
Hmm.
So that's how things like that happen. But so for can is interesting. Can, if you go all the way back, has the same root that gave us the word no, K-N-O-W. The exact same root gave us both words. And in fact, if you go back as far as you can originally meant to know. And we still see it reflexes as well in German, where kennen means to know a person. So what happened with can is that it originally meant to know, and then eventually you would say things like, you know, kind of like the expression, I know shooting a bow and arrow. That is, I know how to shoot a bow and arrow. You'd use this old word can. Then eventually it came to be associated with, well, if you know how to do it, that means that you have the ability to do it, at least the mental ability to do it. Over time, that kind of got stripped away and it became the mental or the physical capability to do it. Then pretty soon, it was just like there was no more knowledge involved at all. It just became having the mental or physical capability to do it. And then finally, the last step was something called root possibility. So it's like if you say like a knife can cut through paper, it just means, you know, there's the knife doesn't really know anything about cutting or anything. It's just a tool. It just has the ability to do so. And so then we came to the present where can is just a bizarre auxiliary that just has this root possibility entailment. And it no longer has any connection to knowing whatsoever. And yet now here we have this word. It's wonderful.
In constructing a language, you also have a lot of choices to make with regard to the sounds contained within that language and how they work together. And it's not just consonants, but it's vowel sounds and diphthongs and aspiration. And you have to choose a set of sounds that seems to belong together.
Right. I think that the way I look at it is when you're creating this sound system, you think about, I mean, well, if you're creating your own language, you think about basically what you want it to sound like. Then what you do is you have to go back, you know, a few thousand years, create an older sound system and think about how do you get from that state to the modern state? Because that's when you start to produce some of the alternations that we kind of take for granted that just happen in natural languages. Like in English, evidently what happened at some point in time is that stops in isolation or in stressed positions acquired aspiration, perhaps to give them more prominence. And so the P in the word spy is far different from the P in the word pie. And sound engineers know this because it drives them nuts to hear that p on the microphone.
That's why there's a sponge in front of every microphone or a net.
Exactly, to kind of cut that off. And anyway, so what happens is that today in English, you have two different realizations of P. And it basically derives from an older state of the language where there really was no distinction between them, but kind of history just produced the distinction, and now we think of them both as the same sound, even though they're not.
What does the tape take to help actors get their brains and also their mouths around the languages that you have constructed and sound like native speakers who, let's face it, take a lot of shortcuts and link words together without realizing it? I think about a sentence in English like, did you have to do that so early? Most American speakers in casual conversation would pronounce that more like, did you have to do that so early?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's actually, it's been interesting working with actors because every actor is slightly different. There are certain actors that I work with, they don't even want to know about what the meaning is and don't necessarily care. They want the sound of it. And so, like, for that, you know, I record every single line for every show I work on, so they all have that. So they listen to exactly how I do it and repeat it exactly how I do it. And I can tell. I can hear my own inflections when they do it, which is really interesting. Other actors, though, are different. Like, I was working with an actress yesterday on a new show I'm working on called Emerald City for NBC. And I was working with her, and she has a large language background. She's spoken Romanian, Spanish, Italian, French, German. She speaks all of them, as well as English. And so she really wanted to know not just which word meant which word. She also wanted to kind of try to figure out the grammar, because for her, that's what made it real for her, to figure out exactly how each word meant what it did. And she was outstanding. So, I mean, but I've seen it work. I've seen it work both ways. I've seen it work all different kinds of ways. It's actually really interesting. It's more of, I think, a reflection of kind of who you are as a language learner, just as a speaker, and you know, also as an actor, to figure out what works for you to get the best performance on screen.
Do I have this right? The first time you watched your dialogue play out on screen, even though you and maybe a couple of the actors might have understood, you were the only ones who would, you were dismayed.
Yeah, and of course it was my fault. That's always the way it works. I'm always, like, you know, disappointed when somebody else is doing, and then it turns out it's my fault. So what happened was the very first line of Dothraki spoken on Game of Thrones is spoken by a foreigner. I mean, in the fictional context, it's spoken by Roger Allam, who played Illyrio Mopatis, and he's welcoming Khal Drogo and a couple of his blood riders to his palace to take a look at Daenerys, Khal Drogo's future bride. And so he says to Khal Drogo, "Ath jomar jomakan khal bejben." But, you know, he does it in kind of a non-native way. So, like, "Ath jomar jomakan khal bejben," which was appropriate, of course. He's not a native speaker of Dothraki. But I could have sworn, so that's how you would say welcome to exactly one person. And I could have sworn that instead what I gave the translation for was how you'd say welcome to two or more people, which is ath jomar chomakea, which sounds different. I was sitting there and, like, I heard him say, you know, what he said, and I was like, oh, brother. It's like... wasn't even close. Is this what I'm gonna have to deal with? And then it's like, this was at the premiere party for the very first premiere party for Game of Thrones. Anyway, so when I got back in the car, I pulled up the script on my phone. I was like, I don't remember. And then I look at him like, oh, yeah, that's what he said. My bad. No, you were good. You were good.
I guess what all you can hope for, right, is that obsessive fans will pay as much attention to this as you do.
Yeah, and there are those that do. Like, I for example, this a fellow I know, I call a friend now, Justin Mansfield. He's probably better with coming up with Valyrian just off the top of his head, you know, just kind of fluently than I am. He'll send me messages in Valyrian, and I'll get them. I'm like, oh, geez, I got to pull up my dictionary, see what's being said here. But yeah, he's really good. And there are several fans. There are a number of fans that got really, really good with Dothraki, And so there are several that are to the point that when there's a new episode of Game of Thrones that airs, I don't know if they can necessarily just understand it on the fly, but they can kind of hear it and write it down and figure it out probably before the episode is over.
Wow. David J. Peterson is my guest. He's a linguist who has created languages for TV series, including Game of Thrones and Dominion and Defiance. His new book is called The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind World Building.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
She's beautiful. Sajora, I don't know how to say thank you in Dothraki.
There is no word for thank you in Dothraki.
Another scene there from Game of Thrones. My guest is linguist David J. Peterson, who writes all the Dothraki dialogue for Game of Thrones, as well as High and Low Valyrian. He's written for Defiance and Dominion as well, and Penny Dreadful and other series. His new book is called The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind World Building. You can join us at 800-933-5372. David, that scene makes me think about this, that it's hard to realize all the phrases that our mother tongue doesn't allow us to express because they're just not sort of part of our thinking. You speak a number of real languages, but I wonder about the kind of thinking you give to the way, the sort of different way that different cultures that are using these languages that you create for them will think and act based on the tools given to them by their language.
Part of it is just research. So, and then part of it is imagination. That's why, you know, there is art to language creation. But you have to kind of put yourself in the mind of the speakers who originally used these words. So that, you know, whatever language you're creating, it's going to involve going back some time. And think about, well, what was life like for them? What was daily life like for them? And how would they have interacted with, you know, whatever object is being discussed? How would they have conceptualized it? And every language does things a little differently. Like if you talk about gaps, in English we have just the word corner, which, you know, is a serviceable word. In Spanish, though, there are actually two words that correspond to corner. There's esquina, and then there's rincón, and they mean different things. Esquina is a corner that that you could basically bump your hip into if you were, like, talking about the corner of a table. It's an outside corner, whereas rincón is more of an interior corner. So, like, if you're talking about the corner of a room, that is a rincón, if you're inside the room. And there, you know, there are two very different concepts if you think about them. You never talk about bumping your hip on an interior corner. That'd be very difficult to do. You know, in English, they're just, you know, for whatever reason, probably an accident of history, we just think of them as exactly the same. It doesn't mean that we can't conceptualize or conceive of an idea of there being an exterior and an interior corner. You just discuss it a little bit and you're like, oh, yeah, those things are different. It's just the case that our language doesn't distinguish between them, you know?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Theron on the line in Plano. Hey, Theron.
Yes, ma'am. How are you all doing today?
Very well.
As a Star Trek fan, I've always wondered how in the world that they developed the language for Klingons. And what's more interesting than that was I remember years ago that the Department of Mental Health in the state of Washington actually had a job posting for somebody who was fluent in Klingonese. Okay?
Wow. Well, what do you know about the origins of Klingon, David?
Wow. First of all, I would say for that job posting, wow. Huh. Maybe they were working in, you know, the children's ward where you got to do things that are just more fun, you know. For Klingon, of course, for the bulk of it, it was created by Mark Okrand. Initially, though, I guess there were some words that were put together by James Doohan in, I believe, the first Star Trek motion picture. But it wasn't until Star Trek III, the motion picture, that they decided that they really needed a full language, and that was where Mark Okren stepped in and kind of took the things that James Doohan had put together and kind of worked them up and created a full language out of it. And, you know, it's a full language that you can learn, and many people do now. You know, it's not great for everything. It's definitely great for discussing, you know, space battles. But, you know, they've made it work. Like the Klingon Language Institute, the users of the Klingon language there have done some extraordinary things. They've translated the Epic of Gilgamesh. They've translated the entirety of Hamlet into Klingon. And this was all with just the words that they were given. So whenever they needed something new, they would come up with, you know, compounds or just ways of expressing things to cover the vocabulary that they didn't have. Pretty ingenious work.
When you start with something where an author like George R.R. Martin has given you a small number of words and phrases as a sort of basis, are there any problems there, things that maybe he wasn't thinking very seriously about in terms of grammatical structure or, you know, word usage that caused a challenge for you later on?
There are the possibility for any number of problems in that scenario. And frankly, I was envisioning all of them, which is that, you know, if somebody doesn't really know a lot about language, you could just think, well, just string the words together. I was delighted by the work that went into the words that he created for Dothraki, because everything cohered. So to give you just a small example, like if you have an adjective and a noun, they can, you know, modify each other in basically one of two ways. Either the adjective comes first or it comes afterwards. In some languages, you can do both. But like, for example, in English, you could say black cat. In Spanish, you would say gato negro, where negro is a word for black and it comes after the word for cat.
Right.
Right. And that's kind of the way those words work. In Game of Thrones, there were a number of places where there were adjectives modifying nouns or other phrases modifying nouns. And in every single instance, the modifier came after the noun, which is consistent and coherent, which is outstanding. I would have expected, first of all, I would have expected it to mirror English order so that the adjective comes first. The fact that it didn't was really cool and interesting. And second, you know, if somebody doesn't, they're not really paying attention to what they're doing, you know, maybe the adjective will come first once, second again, you know, first again, you know, and it'll be kind of a mix-up. I was anticipating having problems like that, but my goodness, everything just cohered so nicely in the words and phrases that George R. Martin created in those three books that, you know, it made my job easier. Now, it did mean that I couldn't do, you know, other, you know, really crazy things. I don't think there's any way I could have made an argument for Dothraki being a polysynthetic language, which was certainly a possibility beforehand. But, you know, the fact that I could rescue every single word and every single phrase in those books and create something where all of that stuff in the books made sense was just really wonderful to me because, of course, his fan base is huge.
It should surprise no one at this point that you are not one to let a challenge go unmet. You've not only constructed a number of spoken fictional languages, but entire systems for expressing them in text, which is not simply a matter of switching the Latin alphabet for corresponding characters that look different. There are just myriad ways we can use characters to convey ideas visually that most of us don't think much about.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I've been fascinated with writing systems probably as long as I've been fascinated with language. I know that one of the earliest things that captivated me was the Arabic writing system, which I just found gorgeous, and I still find gorgeous. And so that actually led me to studying the Arabic language, which I also found to be gorgeous, you know, for entirely separate reasons. The grammar is amazing. I've always been disappointed when you found kind of like writing systems. Like there's one that they made for the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland where they write little phrases. And it's literally just a substitution cipher for the English alphabet. So you're supposed to be going through this kind of, you know, ancient temple. And everything is just written in English with a really bizarre writing system. And it's kind of like, it's a little unsatisfying.
It's like your little Orphan Annie decoder ring could handle that.
Yeah, exactly. Don't forget your Ovaltine. But so when I got the chance to create writing systems for Defiance, for example, I thought, well, all right, no more of this. Let's see what we can do. Now, you know, I wasn't, I didn't have the time to create a really complex writing system like Egyptian hieroglyphs or like the Chinese script or even like a script I did for Kamikawi in the past. But I certainly did have time to create some abugidas, which are very common writing systems in South Asia. That is all over India and Southeast Asia. But, you know, not so common where here in the Western world where we're familiar with alphabets.
How many of these did you have to do, David, before you thought, I know exactly how to get to work here? I mean, the first few times that you created a constructed language, did you have to sort of feel your way through the process in a different way for each set of words?
That's kind of a fun question, because I'll tell you, the very first language I created, I pretty much thought I knew what I was doing right from the get-go. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just sitting. I thought, first of all, that I was the first person ever to create a language for fun. I was totally unaware that Klingon was a language. I was totally unaware that Tolkien had created languages, or anybody else for that matter. And so, you know, I just set about creating a language in the way that I thought made sense. And I thought, yeah, this is pretty good. Yeah, I'm the best ever. And then I found other language creators online and saw what they were doing. And, it was a slow process of realization, but nevertheless, I came to the realization that not only was I not the best at it, I had created one of the worst languages ever. easily. In fact, I would probably just recoded English semantics, which was, a humbling moment for me. So at that point, it was like, all right, I know where I'm at now. And I started learning. I started producing new language projects, and they each got better and better as I went along. And then it's kind of like when I reached some sort of a new level of realization and saw that I, despite the fact that this project was better than the last, I had made some serious errors. I kind of left it and started a new project and basically continued to get better and better that way. So, by the time Game of Thrones came along, I felt pretty good. But at the same time, I certainly wasn't as confident as I was when I created my first language and thought I was the best ever. But, I knew what areas I was weak in. I knew what things I was good at. And in fact, that's why when I got the Dothraki job, I actually started creating the High Valyrian verb system right then, anticipating that I would get the chance to create it later and knowing that I was weakest in verbs and that I wanted that verb system to really be something special.
Linguist David J. Peterson has created languages for TV series including Game of Thrones, Penny Dreadful, Defiance, and Dominion. His new book is The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind World Building. David, it's been so interesting. Thank you for making this time for us.
Girimbose, as we say in High Valyrian. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm glad that there's a word for thank you in High Valyrian.